everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge guest, we get to say hello nasty to the man himself, Steve Martin, who is a hardcore legend from bands Agnostic Front, Straw Dogs, and the FUs, and some other cool stuff we talk about, and also the mastermind and the brains and the the man behind Nasty Little Man PR, who are the, of course, Hello Nasty behind the Beastie Boys record, Hello Nasty, and also the PR company for basically everyone from like Paul McCartney to the Foo Fighters to Beastie Boys, obviously, everyone. Anyway, this is a great episode. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and guest booker and show producer extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on social media at Left4Damian. There's a podcast, an Instagram account, and it is at turnedoutofpunk. There's also a Facebook account, a YouTube account, a TikTok account. I think that's it. And all those can be found. Oh, someone's watch just went off in the background. All those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. I know the watch went off. We can keep going. We can keep going. I have a mystery guest down here right now. So I'm not saying the name. No one knows who it is.
No.
No one knows.
No, we're not a re-record.
It's fine.
No.
Okay, I'll edit that out. Okay, so find the podcast Turned Out of Punk on all those platforms and check that stuff out. If you want to support the show, you can support the show by telling all your friends about this podcast and let them know that this is the place you can go to hear people talk about punk music. A lot, because I talk about punk music too much. Do you think I talk about punk music too much?
Yes, way too much.
Well, you can hear me talk about it a lot too. Poor guest in the room has to hear me talk about it even more than you can do on this podcast. But we do it now twice a week, so more punk rock talk. If you want to check out the stuff I do in my band, you can check out my band. We are called
Fucked Up.
That's right. We are called Fucked Up. You can find us at Fucked Up on Twitter and Instagram. Also, there's a website, fuckedup.cc, and that has a link to our merch store, dates for our upcoming tour with the mighty, mighty Superchunk. And I'm very excited to go on this tour. Holy jeez, I'm excited to see them every night. And we will be playing Homesick Fest with a lot of other great bands. This is going to be a really fun West Coast tour. We also have some new records coming out. I'm going to miss you. I'm not saying I'm not going to miss you every day of that tour. But we've got some records coming out. And, lookingforgold.blogspot.com has relaunched. And Mike from Fucked Up is putting up some really great essays about records and being in a band. And, you know, if you were a fan of the Fucked Up blog back in the day, well, guess what? It is back. Same website and everything. Lookingforgold.blogspot.com, I believe. Check the Fucked Up social media. There's links to that. All right. On to today's show. As I said off the top, today on the show is a hardcore legend and a, I guess, are you okay? Someone's got a little. Okay. Someone's got a little bit of a cold. A punk rock legend and a music legend, industry legend, I guess. We've got Steve Martin on the podcast. Steve Martin is someone that I first became aware of. Well, we talk about this on the show. I'm not going to spoil it and go into that stuff too early or anything like that. But he's been someone I've been trying to get on the podcast for a long time. And this episode had some audio issues, so I managed to kind of clean it up. And now you can finally get to hear it. I'm very excited for you to hear this one because, yeah, this is a guy who links so many worlds and is from hardcore and punk rock and amazing. Anyway, you're going to hear it in a second. Should I shut up and let them hear the episode now, Cam?
Yeah, just shut up.
Okay. So I'm going to sit back, relax, and enjoy Steve Martin on Turned Out
of Punk.
A Punk.
Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, as I was telling you off air, this is something, well, maybe I didn't even get a chance to say this. This is something I've wanted to do for a very long time because your position in both AF and the Straw Dogs FUs has always fascinated me, being one of the few people that I knew that was part of both scenes at that time. Also, I think I spoke to you on the phone years ago when I tried to set up an interview with Sick of It All. So it's great to finally put a face to the name and the voice.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. We worked really closely with Sick of It All in the early to late 90s, really, probably most of that decade. I think we stopped working with them around like 2000, somewhere around there.
Yeah, it would have been 97, I believe. So that would have fit right into the timeline, I guess.
Oh, yeah, built to last.
Exactly. Yeah. So, well, thank you for your help back then, and thank you for your help today. And also, I interviewed Arwin from the band Seringe. Have you heard of Seringe from Indonesia by chance?
No, I haven't heard of them.
They're arguably, like, I guess maybe one of the biggest hardcore bands in the world, you know, just in terms of their popularity. Yeah, it's Indonesia's hardcore scene is probably the biggest in the world. And they're one of the biggest bands in it. And he was just on the podcast and mentioned how years ago he got your address and number and wrote to you, and you sent him a bunch of free Sick of It All stuff, and were one of the people that wrote back to him. Yeah, so your name rings high on this show over the years.
Oh, that's nice to know, because I feel like I've never been more out of touch with what's going on in the international hardcore scene than year after year as I get older.
Well, I spend my life living in it, and I'm completely out of touch as well. So I'm, you're not alone, sadly. No, please do not. But this is not about the international hardcore scene. This is about the Steve Martin hardcore scene. I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Steve, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
I think probably either seeing something about the Sex Pistols on the just network news or something, and or just seeing all the rock magazines that were my portal to the outside world in outside of Long Island, where I grew up in Suffolk County. It was pretty remote, but it was still just a matter of one train transfer on the LIRR to getting into New York City, as I found where I started sneaking out to shows when I was like about 14 years old. But the magazines like Cream and Rock Scene and Circus and the 70s rock magazines that I was learning about music of all genres through, they kind of started writing about punk early on, and it seemed like it was the next big thing at the time, at least to the media, to the music media. And the places where I had been going to read about David Bowie and Led Zeppelin, and you know, I was already playing guitar by the time I heard about that. I heard about this punk rock thing coming out of England, and they just started writing about it. You know, the music press back then is the print press is kind of akin to what the role that social media fills nowadays with turning people onto new stuff. And like, you know, nowadays it's going on someone's YouTube channel who you trust. And back then it was, trusting the people who wrote for Cream magazine in the 70s.
And it felt like punk was like a genre that, it was the first genre that like music journalists were actually participating in. Like a lot of the bands were, you know, early writers, fanzine writers, or you know, Richard Metzger writing and playing in Vom, or the guys in the Gizmos and stuff like that. Like there's always kind
Lester
of this,
Bangs, yeah.
Lester Bangs, exactly. There's a sort of deep connection between journalists. It's like such a postmodern genre that it would make sense that music journalists were kind of like taking hold of it. Even if you look at that early Cleveland stuff, right? And like the fact that punk as a name comes from a fanzine.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I actually wrote about music too. Ever since I first saw David Bowie on Cher's variety show when I was 10 years old, I had my epiphany then that I knew I was going to do something with having to do with music with my life, whether it was the guitar I got my parents to buy shortly after that, or writing about it because I went to school in Boston and got a journalism degree, and I was writing, I was doing show reviews for the independent student paper there and interviewing some artists for it. And even when I was in AF, I was meeting people along the way when we were touring, like Hushead, who was music editor at Thrasher at the time, and I ended up writing a couple pieces for them on as a result of meeting him and becoming friends with him. And I was always looking to do something, and I kind of fell into the PR thing, and it's pretty much stuck because this is the 31st year I've been in business. So
it is the kind of the world that meshes all of it. You're like, you have to know how to deal with bands. You have to know how to deal with the writers, kind of like where the art and the promotion and the commerce all kind of come together is through sort of the PR side of things.
Yeah. And I think the kind of DIY aspect of hardcore that I had come of age in really helped, because you don't wait for anyone to do it for you. Like, you just, I never thought twice about starting this company. I just was kind of like, well, I know a bit about the media and a lot about music, and I know how to talk about this stuff, and I know how to argue and get someone to see my point of view on things. And it was sort of like a happy accident, but my skill set kind of suited something that there was a void in at the time in the music business. Like, there really wasn't anyone doing PR, doing, you know, media promotion, media public relations for bands like the ones that I started out with, like Helmet and Ween and Bad Religion, and even Smashing Pumpkins was the first band I ever booked on SNL. First artist I ever got on the cover of Rolling Stone. When Beastie Boys were looking for a new publicist and toward the end of the Check Your Head tour, Mike D just called me, you know, because I knew them from around, from like the quote unquote the scene. And it just, like I said, it just kind of fell together pretty quickly in the first year or two.
Well, it's interesting, like, weirdly, with the exception of the Smashing Pumpkins, who maybe you can correct me on this, but all those other bands from Ween to Foo Fighters, the Beastie Boys, obviously, to everything, like, it's all punk and hardcore people that are in these bands. Like, Ween's first tape is, like, with Social Decay.
Yeah, it's true. And I saw Beastie Boys back in the day at, like, Danceteria and The Rat, when they were just the hardcore band, and when Adam Horovitz was still in the Young and the Useless.
Yes.
Who I saw at CB's one time. Yeah, they all had those roots in it. Like, Helmet was kind of like post-hardcore, mm-hmm. if anything. The Ween guys, like, yeah, they had crossover and shared members with Rollins Band and whatever. So, yeah, there was, again, it was a lot of that kind of DIY ethos that came out of that came out of that scene, permeated what happened with alternative rock. I mean, Dave Grohl was in Scream before he was in Nirvana.
And Dane Bramage before that. And was it Mission Impossible? Yeah, before that. That's the thing I love about this scene. And, like, kind of, you know, and I think it was even, like, at the time realizing that, oh, my God, Hello Nasty on the Beastie Boys thing is the same people that I called for the Sick of It All interview. So there's, like, this sort of connection. And then some old bullshit's kind of coming in around then too. And sort of, like, you know, you're able to put the pieces together. But now, years later, it's all punk. Like, it's all people that came out of the sort of punk scene. I imagine you're like Dave Grohl, I'm sure you would have came across at some point with the Straw Dogs or, you know, AF with Scream and stuff, right?
Oh, we did. They opened. I had seen Scream a bunch of times before Dave was in the band when Kent Stax was playing drums. But then I remember they opened for us, I think, at Lupo's in Rhode Island early in the stage that he had just taken over. And we were just all like, who's that kid who's drumming for Scream? He's really taking them to the next level.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we definitely crossed paths before.
There's an amazing video on YouTube of him playing with Dane Bramage. And it's just like, this is a guy that's, Yeah, I love Dane Bramage. I love that LP, but he's clearly like overplaying the band so much. It's like a Pinto with a Ferrari engine in it or something.
Yeah, there's weird Dane Bramage trivia, related trivia, is that one time when I had a band after AF that just played two or three shows that was kind of like a New York hardcore all-stars post-hardcore type of band called Angry Head. And we were auditioning bass players, and it was me and Petey Hines, the drummer from Murphy's Law and the Cro-Mags. And we, Ruben came in an audition and we played with him, and it went really well. I don't know what ever happened. We just kind of like, the band kind of fizzled out, but he never played live with us, but we had like one really cool rehearsal with him.
Oh, that's awesome. So what's the deal with Angry Head? I've never heard of this. Did you guys record it all, or just the two shows?
No, just the two shows we played that I can remember. We played CBGB and we played Wetlands when they were having shows there. I don't know if you remember that place.
Infamous time in hardcore.
Yeah, yeah. Early 90s when I was in my kind of wilderness period between having left my job at the label that AF recorded for, Relativity. And it was just like freelance writing for a living, thinking about the PR thing, and possibly thinking about continuing music. So it was me, Anthony Communal from Killing Time was singing.
Oh my God.
Arthur Smilios from Gorilla Biscuits and Civ was playing bass, and Petey was playing drums.
Oh, that's a real all-star group. What's the vibe of this thing?
It was like post-hardcore. Like it was, there was nothing that like went to like the like hardcore Bad Brains BPM, like nothing that fast, but it was like, it was kind of like, you know, had elements of kind of sort of quasi-metallic alternative type of, I don't know how to label it.
Yeah, that kind of New York period. Like the late 80s into the early 90s, where there's sort of that transition that kind of like the groove kind of hits New York, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't have like slap bass or anything like that, but it was more like, it was more like Killing Joke and Chrome and stuff like that, but with like hardcore vocals and heavier guitar, bass and drums type of vibe.
So it kind of, would it fit on like AMRAP? Would it kind of fit with that helmet kind of world of stuff? It sounds amazing from your description.
It probably would have. I'll see if I might still have a cassette, a board tape from the CB show, because I know we had that at some point, but I have no idea where it is. And I have no idea how to even play a cassette at this point. But I could probably give it to somebody who could digitize it for me, with all the people I know who have studios.
Well, I think there's a lot of hardcore kids that want to hear that. I think that there's an audience looking for that tape to be digitized now.
Well, there's an audience of about probably roughly 500 people who've ever seen it between those two shows.
Yes, so. Exactly. Well, that's the thing about, you know, and obviously we're jumping way ahead, but, you know, New York during that period, and like, I guess the general kind of New York area, the greater New York area, there's just like so much that's happened band-wise, and like, you know, you can talk about hardcore, but then there's also that sort of like pig fucker, for the worst term possible, but like noise rock stuff that's also happening. Same time, hip hop stuff's happening. Like, it feels like actually all over the East Coast, there's such an explosion of culture that kind of kicks off in like the early 80s and then right into the 90s and everything that kind of happens there. It's really like, it's wild how much stuff's happening, turning out.
Yeah, you have from Go-Go down in D.C. to like, the metal stuff that was coming out of Florida at the time, to like, yeah, the quote unquote scum rock scene, whatever you would call it in New York, that White Zombie came out of. There was so much stuff going on at that point.
So I guess going back to when you first started going to shows, you mentioned being into the glam stuff. Were you aware of like Milk and Cookies or any of that sort of New York glam stuff that was happening at the same time as Bowie?
Not really. I was a little too young to have gotten into that. Like I'm old enough that I was at CBGB a lot, but I'm young enough that I never made it to Max's.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like the sweet spot that I'm in.
Yeah.
Like, but I, it was a great time to come of age, because like when I first started going to shows, it was like 1979 would be the first year that I actually like snuck in and went to a show like on my own with some friends without like parental supervision. And it was the Police, UK Subs, and Steel Pulse at the Palladium.
Whoa, I didn't even know that happened. That was UK Subs opening for the Police with Steel Pulse. That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, as an unforgettable show. It was at the, it was on the Regatta de Blanc tour, the Police's second tour, when they were first starting to like blow up. And that was a great show. And then like from there, it was like 79 and 80 were like such great years, because like, so punk had kind of, was kind of on the wane at that point, as far as like, it, it was clear that it wasn't going to become a commercial success to match its critical acclaim. But you could still go see the Ramones and the Heartbreakers and the Clash and all these great bands that I was seeing like sort of later on, like three albums in or so or whatever. I think the first time I saw the Ramones was probably on like Pleasant Dreams or End of the Century or Subterranean Jungle, one of those records. Not that it mattered. It was still like a life-changing show. But the thing is, there was like all these kind of like genreless bands that were coming out of this post-punk explosion that I would go see on like, you know, seeing like two shows a month, but those shows would be like Gang of Four and Public Image Limited and Susie and the Banshees and Echo and the Bunnymen and the Cramps. And like, it just, it was like, there was like one genre of music at the time and it was just good. Like no two bands sounded alike really, but they were all great. And then at the same time, I was starting to go see like a couple of years later, like 80, 81, 82, I started going to see like Minor Threat and Bad Brains and Black Flag. And, you know, it was just it was kind of a seamless transition.
Well, I find it so fascinating that, like you said, 79, 80, Bad Brains moving to New York, and you have that end of sort of this whatever New York, like you meant, like the sort of the genreless time period, post-punk, just not as a genre, but it's just post-punk as a term. And then you kind of have the rise of New York hardcore happen. But it is such a fascinating period. Like I love the Mad and Student Teachers, and like there's all this sort of like weird stuff that New York was, you know, Stimulators, like that was popping off there, where I don't know, I feel like they're kind of lost in the monolith that is New York hardcore or New York punk. There's a sort of like you're saying, a gap year that's fascinating.
Yeah, there is kind of like a lost generation of bands that were like the New York thrash cassette on on Roar type of like generation. Like they were kind of like pioneers, but they never hit the gold rush.
So did you do any bands like around then in New York?
Yeah, I played drums in a band that played a couple shows called Bacteria Glasses, and I'm still in touch with one of the guys from that band, this guy Mark Furnish. He's a very successful criminal defense attorney, and he was a running buddy of mine for a while with shows, like one of the only people who would take the trip into New York City with me from Long Island and like risk missing the last train home and have to like sleep in Penn Station. Mind you, like late 70s, early 80s Penn Station, when it was really Penn Station.
Yeah, exactly. Real New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because there's people that talk about growing up in New York, and it goes right into the late 80s, it seems, where you're just going to get mugged. It's like, that's just the reality of going to Lower East Side, or you're going to be in a crew, or you're going to have to do something to protect yourself, because it's like violence is a real thing.
Yeah. I remember the first show I actually went to like deep into the Lower East Side was a place called the Sin Club on Avenue C. And I think it was a COC. COC was definitely playing like the Eric Icke lineup.
Oh, amazing. And
I forget who else was playing, but the show got cut short because someone like had some altercation with the locals, and somebody got stabbed, and someone came back with a gun. And it's just, I had never experienced anything like that in my sheltered suburban upbringing.
Well, it's so fascinating how, and this is happens time and time again, I think it's New York really is where it starts, but how punk winds up being sort of the lichen of gentrification for a lot of these neighborhoods and a lot of these places. Cause like, by the time I was going to New York in the mid 90s, early 2000s, the Lower East Side was already by then like sort of this just storied sort of almost tourist attraction on the way to become the tourist attraction is now.
Yeah, I think it the kind of dividing line for me was that incident with the kids who were here from out of town who said, what are you going to do, stab me or something? Do you know that story?
Yeah, I've heard that story.
That book, Lush Life, is based on that. And that seemed to me to be the dividing line in the new and old Lower East Side. And that was like sometime in like mid-2000s or something. And then after that, I don't know if it was increased police presence or just that seemed to be the wake up call when I was like, oh yeah, this is like Ludlow Street and Orchard Street are becoming kind of like Daytona Beach. Like it's kind of like, you know, college kids coming in to drink and party and whatever. And it's going to be made safe now somehow. And it would, yeah, that was kind of the last gasp pre-gentrification.
Well, it feels like it's like the punk club will eventually invite sort of the health food store or the record store, or the cool bookstore, which will bring the antique shops, which will bring the cafe, which will bring, you know, and it's interesting to watch it play out on the Brooklyn waterfront more recently, kind of in the same way with DIY spaces. It happened much more acceleratedly, I guess.
Everything happens much more acceleratedly now. It's just the way things are. Like if you want to get the word out about a new spot, like you just post about it. You don't have to like go out at night with a wheat pasting brigade and flyer like the cool places or like, you know, find the cool record store to like put your flyer up with the phone number to call to, or the address or whatever. Yeah, it's just everything's online now. And so it just moves faster.
Speaking of, I guess, wheat pacing and leading to graffiti, did you ever see Frontline?
I saw them open for Bad Brains once at CBGB in like 83 or so, something like that. I have zero memory of it, but I'm pretty sure it was Frontline, Antidote, and maybe Mode of Ignorance or something.
What a bill. Oh my God.
Something like that. I might be conflating a couple shows, but it might've been one of those shows where they were playing like a matinee and a night show. And like some of those bands were playing the first show. Some of them were playing the second show.
That's awesome. So do you remember when that kind of like, you know, and maybe this is something that just has been perceived over time or kind of hyped up over time, but like there seems like there's a shift that kind of happens where hardcore kind of comes in, or like tougher hardcore seems comes in, like bands like The Abused and Antidote and stuff like that, like and Frontline and stuff like that. Do you remember that kind of coming in and the change happening, or is that something that just is so gradual?
It was kind of, yeah, to me it was kind of like I came into it. It didn't come in for me, because by the time I was going to hardcore shows, it was like 1982, and I was just seeing those bands usually as like the local openers for like something like MDC or DRI or someone who was coming through New York and, you know, Antidote or Frontline or, you know, I remember the first time I saw Agnostic Front, they were opening on at the Old Rock Hotel on Jane Street. They were opening for Channel 3 and Crowd.
Oh, what a show.
Yeah, that's that was wild. A great show.
Did you ever see Gilligan's Island? Sorry, I didn't cut you off.
Gilligan's Revenge.
Or Gilligan's Revenge. Did you ever see Gilligan's Revenge?
Yeah, I saw them.
Oh, that's awesome.
They were pretty great. I remember seeing them and my impression being like, oh, these guys can play. Like, yeah, they were really good. I remember exactly now when it just popped into my head. I remember when the first time I saw Gilligan's Revenge, and probably the only time was in 84 when I had first joined the FUs, the winter of 84, we came down for a one-off just to headline a CB's matinee. And I'm pretty sure Gilligan's Revenge opened that.
Awesome. Like, that's the thing, is all this stuff has become so storied, and like these tapes that were lost forever that people have dug up. Like it's amazing because it seems like it was a very small scene for the impact it had globally.
Yeah, it definitely was. And like, I remember, like, I can't remember for the life of me, like, how I kind of insinuated myself into the Boston hardcore scene, but I just did. And I knew I wanted to play in a band or start a band or whatever. And I had jammed with a bunch of people locally, and I had found out like where the rehearsal spaces were, where like the FUs and DYS rehearsed. And like, I became friends with the guys from Jerry's Kids and Gangrene somehow. And like, it wasn't really that hard to seek them out, because at that time people were like, you know, a couple hundred people at a show was a pretty huge show. If you were like playing like the Rat or the Channel in Boston or the Paradise in Boston. But yeah, I somehow got my foot in the door, and like, my freshman year of college was 1983. And, you know, by the summer of 1984, I was auditioning for the FUs. And so it happened really quickly, and it was a small, tight knit scene. And like, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those people too. So it's definitely contracted again over the years. Like, social media kind of reinvigorated it for a second there, like starting in like around like 2008, 2009. Like, that seems to be when everybody started doing all the reunion shows.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is now it's just everyone's doing reunion shows. Like post pandemic, especially, like, every band that was broken up decided, well, maybe we should give it another shot. And so it just feels like, yeah, everyone's on tour constantly now.
Yeah. Yeah. And everyone is on tour constantly now at the level of clients that I work with too. Like, I was saying to Metallica's manager last year, like, I just said off the cuff, like, oh man, it's been so crazy this year with everybody making up for lost time in the pandemic. And they're all like wanting to like get their albums out and get their tours going. And like, they're all on top of each other. And he said like, well, 2023 is going to be even worse. And he was right.
Yep.
Stage observation.
Yeah. I guess it was, everyone's just getting the machine warmed up again for 2023 and 2022.
Yeah. And I think there has to be a break soon, because it's not sustainable. Like, there's just too many people out there on top of each other.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely feels like, well, I think, you know, I already feel with my own band and my own tours, like, I'm sick of these people again. So that'll set in.
Oh yeah.
That you can always rely on that side of things rearing its head again in the bands.
Well, that could be a net positive at a certain point. Like, if you take a little break, that might not be the worst idea.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, anyway, back to more pleasant topics and more pleasant times. Like, it's interesting, because go to Boston, and this is something that's definitely been played up over time, but it is something that's come up on this podcast. There was legitimate beef between those two scenes.
Yeah, rivalry. Yeah.
At different times. It was like, were people just like, is that more on like sort of a citywide level than a personal level? Did you find any sort of like weirdness from any of these bands?
Not really. I mean, that was kind of like, that predated the actual like physical altercations that came out of that. Like, or I don't know if they were like fights so much as they were kind of like dance floor challenges about, you know, who could dance harder. I'm not really sure.
But depends who you ask, I find, and on this podcast. Yeah. I've definitely heard very different accounts of this thing over the years. It's like I don't know, like an assassination of JFK type thing, with many different perspectives depending on where you were standing those nights at those shows.
Good analogy, yeah. I mean, I remember both scenes being pretty violent in terms of like the intensity in which people reacted to the music. I mean, New York and Boston Pits back then were insane. And I do remember, you know, hearing about the rivalry from both sides. And I don't really remember experiencing it, because I remember being nervous the first time I was coming down and playing to play CDs with the FUs in 84. And like, oh, is there going to be like any like remnants of this like scene rivalry, or, you know, beef that people have with Boston bands? Or I remember being a little nervous about that, but there was nothing. It was just, we had a great crowd, it was packed, and it was a lot of fun. It was a fun show. And then the whole way I ended up auditioning for AF, trying out for AF, was because the Straw Dogs played a show supporting them at TT the Bears in Boston. And a friend of mine from New York, John Golden, his nickname is Wrecking Machine. You may have heard of him. He was like a scene personality. Mm-hmm. He had come up with AF and for the show, and he tipped me off. So like, oh, they're going to want to replace a lead guitar player. You should try out. And he introduced me to Roger, and I just said like, yeah, I can be down like during my Thanksgiving break from school if you wanted to like give me a chance. And they gave me a shot and it worked.
Yeah, I've always heard that AF is like a very familial kind of band. Like it's like joining a family a little bit. Did you find that? Or is that once again something perceived from the outside? Or is it like
I guess so, because like it's kind of like it's definitely stayed with me over the years, even when I've gone for like years without talking to Roger or Vinny, who, you know, then being the only two guys who are still in the band from when I was in it. But yeah, I've said this before, like when I see them, when they come through New York every now and then, like Roger will text me and just say like, hey, you want to get up and play a song with us? And I do. And even the guys that I don't really know at all or all that well, like Mike and Craig and those guys who've been in the band for like whatever 10 years 20 years, which seems like a lot by an objective measure, but isn't that is like, you know, a third to a half of the time the band has existed,
just but a sliver in their career of
but it's just, yeah, it's just kind of like stepping in back into like a very comfortable place, like a comfort zone that is kind of a familial vibe. Yeah, it's kind of like once you're in for life, and you may get called back up to the to perform at any given time. But I always appreciated that Roger always said like, you know, I didn't want to put you on the spot, that I wanted to make sure that you like were playing, and that, you know. You know, he doesn't know. For all he knows, I might have not touched a guitar for 3 years between AF tours or whatever coming to New York. So
you gotta be ready.
Appreciative of that.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's funny. Someone told me one time the analogy I heard is that if you gave Agnostic Front a loaf of bread, it would be shared amongst all the members. Whereas there are certain bands that if you gave them a loaf of bread, all the members would be dead, having fought over that loaf of bread.
I had my conflicts with guys in the band when I was in, just like everyone does. We had our like spats and tiffs and petty bullshit and whatever that is like such a big deal when you're like 22 years old, but like doesn't mean shit when you like look back at it when you're in your 50s, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like anytime I see like, you know, Craig Sitari or you know, anybody like that, like it's always great to see someone from that period of your life who's still doing the thing that they loved and still involved in, like they, you know, from what I can tell, they seem legitimately happy for me that I've found my niche in the business side of things. So there's that as well.
Yeah, it does feel like family. Like there can be small conflicts, but at the end of the day, you're still part of the family.
Yeah. I mean, I fight with my own family from time to time. So
don't we all?
Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Going back to Boston, I got to ask you about one of my favorite compilations ever, the Boston Goes Deaf compilation.
Which, I was amazed that you had that. I've never seen a copy of that in the wild.
I bought this on the strength of you appearing on this compilation. A friend of mine named Glenn Salter, who played in the band MSI, sold me this record being like, it features a member of the FUs in it. And I was like, really? And he showed me your name on the track. And then also that Slick Rick, the Ruler, makes his first ever appearance on a record, I believe, on this record as well. on the next track, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's wild.
I played on the Fat Girls track, right?
Fat Girls, which is an amazing track by the Fat Girls of Boston. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, no, he's two tracks down on Susie Q.
Oh, which, okay.
Slightly less progressive for women, Susie Q, than the Fat Girls of Boston track. But both are classic. And it's so, to me, this record is like this, and obviously Frontline and the Beastie Boys and things like that. But like, I love that connection between hip hop, which is the major cultural revolution that's happening at that time, and punk and hardcore, which is the other sort of giant revolution that's happening at that time.
Yeah. I mean, that was just, I think how that happened, that I wound up on that track, was that Steve Barry, the guy who's producing the Straw Dogs EP, or maybe the We Are Not Amused album.
Okay.
One of the two, just asked me to stay after when we were finishing a session. It was like, you know, the other guys left, and he asked me to just play the riff from Trigger Finger, I think it is, and just play it like in a slightly different rhythm to this drum machine loop that he had programmed. And I just did, and I didn't know what was going to come of it. Like, I got a copy of it when it came out, but who knows whatever happened to that. He also, it's funny that you bring that up, because he also did the same guy. His nickname was Mr. Beautiful, and he had a compilation that he put out called Mr. Beautiful Presents All Hard. And the first song on it was the FUs doing the original version of In Deep, the Straw Dogs song.
Oh, he put that out too. That's wild. I didn't even make that connection.
Yeah, an old friend of mine gifted me with a copy of that record last year. And I hadn't seen a copy of that in ages either. So these specters from my past are coming back to me. I wouldn't say coming to haunt me, because it's all like good memories, but it's stuff that I had totally and completely forgotten, like 100%. Like, if you hadn't brought up that Boston Goes Deaf compilation, there's no way I would have ever thought of that again in my life.
Well, it's funny, because this is one of those records that's huge to me. Like, finding out about this record, I'm surrounded by too many records, but this is one of those records that I always think about. With hip hop, and sadly, a lot of the early stuff is kind of overshadowed by the stuff that came out of New York.
Yeah.
And so this was my first exposure to early sort of earlier Boston hip hop stuff. And it's great. It's like such a cool compilation. So you and also Slick Rick kind of make the move to New York around the same time, back to New York, I guess, for you, but at the same time.
Yeah. Coincidentally,
this compilation launched a lot of progression back to New York. What were those FUs? What was like that era of New York? Boston, like, because I just rewatched the American Hardcore documentary for a screening of it the other day, and it really did feel kind of like the air getting let out of a balloon at a certain point, post everyone kind of putting out their more mature records, and Straw Dogs are kind of the band that kind of keeps going, and I guess Freeze as well, but it feels like a lot of the bands are kind of giving up at this point.
Yeah, it seemed, you know, SSD played their final show around that time, and DYS kind of fell apart, and Jerry's Kids, I think, played their first farewell show, I think it was 1984. Yeah, it was like, I definitely joined at the tail end, and I'm sure like the change of the name from the FUs to the Straw Dogs, I think probably was a function of like Bob for Apples leaving the FUs and us getting more kind of rock in our songwriting structures and stuff. Yeah, it was not an easy time to be in a band like that. Like when I first joined the band, it was like my first show was we were opening for Suicidal Tendencies at the Channel for like thousands of people. So, and then we were like headlining a couple other shows like in short succession after that, and like opening for like the Minutemen at one point, and I think 7 Seconds we opened for a couple of shows later. And like that was when it was still feeling kind of vibrant and happening. But then like by the mid 80s, by like 85, 86, it just felt like it was petering out. And I look back on it now and just realize like, oh, it wasn't like at the time we were kind of like struggling to find good shows and good bills to get on and good venues to play. And in hindsight being 2020, I realize now, like, it wasn't meant to last for more than a couple of years. So it kind of ran its course.
Well, it's interesting to, like, look at that period, because it is such a, like, 83 to 85, it seems like everything's kind of winding down for the first wave of American hardcore, right? And, like, you know, Dinosaur Jr. comes out of Deep Wound at that time, and, you know, Replacements and Husker Du start going more college rock kind of vibes with their music. And you have that sort of happening at the same time as you have the Boston scene going through this metamorphosis. And that's why you Straw Dogs are kind of this bridge band, because then a few years later, 87, 88, you have Youth Crew stuff and Sick of It All and everything popping off in New York and Slapshot and Wrecking Crew in Boston. It feels like there's almost this sort of, like, gap. Once again, another gap year. Like, it's interesting how these generational gap years in between scene flourishes all the way through punk and hardcore, it seems.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. And, like, we were, like, playing show, these weird shows. Like, we'd go down to, like, 85, we'd go down to DC. I remember we played an outdoor show there where we were definitely the odd men out on that bill, where Straw Dogs were playing, like, with, like, Ignition and Rites of Spring, I think. And, you know, it was really, really strange. And, like, I remember talking to the government issue guys then, talking to John Stab and Tom Lyle, and they were saying how they were feeling, like, kind of men out of time as well. Like, they were feeling out of sync with what was going on with the Revolution Summer and that whole thing. And and it was before Fugazi formed. Like, I think Ian was doing Embrace or Egg Hunt or whatever at that point.
Mm-hmm.
That was a weird time. You kind of need these, like, regrouping kind of evolutionary gap year type of periods for the next iteration to kind of work itself out. It's like, now that's kind of happening with these bands like Turnstile and Code Orange and all these bands that I'm seeing, like, calling themselves hardcore bands. And, you know, it doesn't sound like what I was playing in 1987, you know, or whatever. But yeah, I look back on it, and it was definitely like, I was definitely playing in bands like that at some, like, difficult transitional periods for the music and scene as a whole, for sure.
Yeah, like, it feels like right now, obviously, I think we're kind of an explosion. Like, the bands you mentioned, Scowl, like, there's a sort of God's Hate. There's this wave of hardcore, you know, resonating with people again. But, you know, there are those lean years before this. And I think the thing that's fascinating is that if you follow this sort of lineage from these bands, like, these bands were the kids that were going to the shows of the bands that were going to see you play with AF. It's amazing how there is this sort of lineage that is completely independent, completely kind of underground. Obviously, eventually it gets above ground, but it does keep finding a way to find that space to put on that show, even though you can't do it anymore on the Lower East Side or the Brooklyn waterfront. There's going to be somewhere, someplace that a kid's going to be able to put on a hardcore show and make completely uncommercial music for no other reason than they want to make it.
Yeah. And I mean, that was something that was good. That was pure and honest about that kind of music, because at the time that the Lower East Side was all, like, matinees at CBGB and occasionally Great Gildersleeves, and sometimes the bigger bands would play, like, someplace like Irving Plaza, like a Misfits or a Minor Threat show that would draw, like, 1,000 people there. There was no commercial aspirations. We were just doing it because it was something that everybody had to do. That everyone had to get off their chest, that everyone had to get out of their system, that everyone, you know, had to, thoughts and feelings and emotions and aggressions that had to be expressed. There wasn't, like, you know, no one was saying, like, well, maybe if we move this middle eight part into the intro and, like, change and write the bridge like this, and then maybe we'll get on, like, alternative radio or something, or college radio. I mean, I don't think college radio was even a thing until, like, the first REM record, which kind of came out after the whole hardcore explosion.
Well, I think it starts in Boston, right? Like, the Police famously getting played in Boston first on sort of like college radio stations. But you're right, like it's kind of punk once again, an outgrowth of punk and hardcore bands like REM, bands like Husker Du, bands like Replacements, kind of creating this lane for it.
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't obviously college radio stations were playing music way before that, but I mean,
college
radio as a genre or whatever, as a category or as like later, not much later than that, as a department at every major or independent record label, they had a college radio guy all of a sudden, or girl or whatever.
Or CMJ was my introduction to the College Music Journal, which was like that publication that would come with that free CD. And once again, like it was kind of like really going back to what you're saying, that genreless time in music that eventually becomes college rock, because there is no real genre to it other than it wouldn't have fit on mainstream radio, but there was a growing audience for it.
Yeah. Like whether that's like REM and the Replacements, or whether it's like Husker Du or No Trend or whatever, like you know, it's just stuff that wasn't going to get played on your mass market FM radio station.
One band that definitely got played on major radio stations at a certain point were the New Kids on the Block, and I've been obsessed with this band Miracle Boy, which was a Boston band around the time that you're in Boston, featuring Jordan Knight and EK, who later played drums in Warzone. Did you ever see them? I never saw them. Weird. No one saw them. Like I've asked everyone from Elgin James to Gerard, like anyone that was in Boston during that time, because I know they played shows at the Rat. I've seen like two listings for, or maybe it's the Middle East, but then two listings for them playing shows. So I know they played at least a show, but there is a New Kids on the Block punk band. And then later on, EK, I think, is in a New Kids on the Block video. And there's Jordan's wearing a Youth of Today shirt at one point in one of their videos. So there is some sort of.
That sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
But it was, the band was called Miracle Boy?
Miracle Boy. Or Miracle Boys, maybe. But yeah. And I've only seen the two listings for it. I've never actually seen flyers. But a fascinating, weird thing that, like, once again, not to beat this drum to death, but, like, everything comes back to this genre in some way.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's kind of like the mysterious band that very few people have ever heard of existing. It's kind of like their version of my Two Angry Head gigs.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's, I find time and time again, if there's someone out there in this world that does something culturally interesting, chances are at some point in their life they were into punk and hardcore or hip hop. Because, you know, if you were into mainstream stuff, you were content enough to just consume the culture that was given to you.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the people that I work with, they're all like, so many of them have roots in like having seen the same shows or the same tours as the same bands and the same tours that I saw. Like we have that in common and talk about like, oh yeah, I saw the Bad Brains when they got back together in 1987, like, or whatever the case may be. Or like, you know, I was at that first like Metallica show at the Rat when it was just like all like punk kids and like a few like really freaky like black metal type guys, like, and black metal, I mean the Venom album, not like the Swedish or Norwegian or whatever stuff.
Original black metal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, one of my best friends in the business is a guy named John Silva, who you may have heard of. He's the only manager Dave Grohl's ever had. He managed Nirvana. He manages the Foo Fighters. We have more clients in common with our two companies than I have with anybody else, because he manages Beck, Queens of the Stone Age, St. Vincent, Jenny Lewis. We have a bunch of things in common. And, you know, it came out early on when the first mutual client we had was Beastie Boys in the early 90s, and started talking about like, he made some reference or something to Maximum Rock and Roll and like Wristy Tit or something. And I was like, how the fuck do you know what that is? And he was like, Jello Biafra was my roommate when I was in college. So
how did I not know this? Jello's been on the show like three times and I didn't know this.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, is that in Colorado or is that in SF?
SF. He was, Silva was a contributor to Maximum Rock and Roll in like the second, from the second issue on, I think.
You're blowing my mind. I had no idea about that. Like, I assume because, like, you know, every artist you mentioned there, I can, from back on, I can kind of trace back to punk in some way. But, well, I had no idea that he wrote for MRR. I find MRR is weirdly, like, once again, talking to my friend in Indonesia, like, that thing was such an important cultural lifeline for people. Like, you book your own fucking life later on, that thing they put about how to tour.
Oh, yeah.
Those are so important.
Book Your Own Fucking Life was a godsend for me when I was starting my company, because I started my company in 1992 and no one was on the internet then. And like, we would just go through like, you know, call promoters in like Des Moines and say like, you know, well, who should we call to like, let people know about the show? And they'd be like, well, there's like two publications here or whatever. It just took, everything took so fucking long because everything was done over the phone too. And like, you'd be leaving a voicemail for the pop music editor and hoping that they would call you back. And like it, but when that Book Your Own Fucking Life series started coming out, like that was great. Like that really helped a lot. I mean, because when I was touring for a living, everything was about like people who would share like who was the cool promoter by word of mouth. And like, you get a list of phone numbers and like you get a list of phone card numbers that had been bootlegged that you could use to like make long distance calls from the road. And you know, everything was so reliant on like this network of people who would share information that, you know, it's not that different from people who like post it now, but they had to actually physically give it to you, like mail it to you or fax it to you like a few years later. Like, it wasn't as easy as just, you know, logging on and Googling like, you know, cool punk venues, St. Louis, you know, it wasn't that easy.
Yeah. Like, it really does feel like the entire way people tour, like there's an interesting dividing line talking to people that were involved in punk pre DOA, and giving Black Flag, and then Black Flag ultimately popularizing the way that you're describing about touring. And then the bands that came before it, where you just like drive to some random part of the country, play a show, drive to some random other place, hope you get a show there. You're relying on bars, you're doing residencies, you know, you're not playing to an audience. It's really that network that's established by these bands that's just kind of passed on. And then it evolves where like Book Your Own Fucking Life is the next iteration. But then post Nirvana and post like Green Day and that sort of like alternative mainstreaming that happens, that's the route that we still all tour by. Like, that's the thing we still all kind of follow, is that sort of like evolution of this thing, but now on a more structured, you know, not corporate, still independent, but still like the same sort of network of promoters that goes back to punk. Like, it really is an outgrowth of hardcore.
Yeah, there's an established circuit now.
Yeah.
And yeah, it does go back to punk rock and hardcore. I mean, look who, you know, look at Golden Voice.
Yeah.
First time I remember seeing Golden Voice logo was on like Dead Kennedys and Minor Threat or whatever that mega show was at the Olympic Theater that turned into a riot at LA. Like, that was a legendary show. Like, it was, I remember hearing about it because that was the show that SSD like drove straight across the country to play.
Yes. Al talked about that when he was on the show. Just the kind of way of the different approach to touring that SSD would, I guess, pick up with. But
yeah, nowadays you could, you know, route a tour so that you like play, you know, drive to like somewhere in Western Pennsylvania first, and then make your way to like Cleveland, and then make your way to Chicago and Minneapolis, and you know, break that trip up a little rather than just like driving 3 days straight
to get there and play and then turn around and drive back. But
yeah, I think they play one other show.
They did. I forget what he says on the show. He does to say they played one other show, but like, it's really that show. Obviously that's the main reason they're going out there, but you could still, you know, as you're saying, route that tour now much more efficiently and wind up playing a Golden Voice show in the form of Coachella in California. So it still all works out. You're still doing something with Golden Voice at the end.
Yeah. Though I don't think they had radius clauses back then.
No, I think it was a very, you know, a very different Golden Voice. I just learned the other day that Golden Voice is actually a strain of cannabis that apparently made you sing better. And that's where they got the name for the company.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was very, once again, post-watching American Hardcore and being reminded about the Golden Voice connection, that I dug into Golden Voice and saw there's a twin love of mine going on there with cannabis and with punk rock in the early formation of Golden Voice. But look at Gus from Florida, who now manages Blink-182 and was like the main promoter for Florida shows for years, right? Like, there's so many people that are this music industry now, or have come from this thing into this music industry. And once again, like, musically, you were given permission to do things. You were a kid and you wanted to see a band come to your town. You booked them.
Yeah, you wrote, you sent a letter to their PO box and said, like, you know, I can get 150 kids to this VFW hall. And that was the way it went. And I definitely played a lot of shows like that. But it was weird because with AF, it was kind of a mishmash of that and like those kinds of shows, like, you know, the cool kid who could put on a show in like a basement club in Orlando, or like a Knights of Columbus hall in some smaller town, or you played some weird venues. But then we'd also be playing like the Stone in San Francisco, which is like 1500 capacity, like metal club, or, you know, the Metro in Chicago, and like legit places. So it was always a kind of patchwork of these different kinds of shows. Like, it wasn't like it is now, where there's just a kind of circuit, like a club circuit that you play.
It seems like you join AF at a really kind of fraught period for the band too. Post Cause for Alarm, there's like a backlash, right? Like MRR, going back to MRR, there's definitely hatred on that from MRR at that point, right?
Yeah.
And you know, like, I love, obviously, the live record is one of the most classic live records ever to come out of hardcore, and Liberty and Justice is now, like, you know, a beloved record.
Yeah, I definitely got that vibe at the time. And I remember thinking consciously when I was writing this, like, I wrote a decent chunk of Liberty and Justice. And when I was writing, I was just trying to, like, keep all of their previous stuff, like, out of my head, and just try to write stuff that was kind of where the music, where that type of music might be going, rather than where it had been, because I wasn't really into like the kind of pure hardcore revivalists. Like, I wasn't feeling like the Youth of Today and Bold and stuff like that. Like, I wasn't really, I mean, Sick of It All were great, but they were a little more progressive than those bands were in their songwriting, and they were a little more ambitious, I think. But yeah, I was just trying to write something that didn't sound like anything else. And it was frustrating at the time, but it does seem like, you said, it does seem like people have come around to it over the years. And people have come around to Cause for Alarm.
Oh, which, definitely, yeah.
You know, that record was pretty groundbreaking at the time, even though it was made by a band that was like a hair's breadth away from splitting up and had like other people coming in to write songs and write lyrics and play drums from on the record from other bands. Like, you know, that was the band that was on the record was not the band that played that tour. You know, I remember seeing them on that tour when they were playing with GBH. And it was a totally different lead guitar player and drummer, I think. Yeah, because Alex Kynan and Louis Beato played on the record. They didn't play on the tour.
It's there. Yeah, it does feel like that band, like, you watch live videos from that period, like even that, I think it's like the Wetlands live riot video. Is it Wetlands where there's a huge riot where the crowd is riding and then the security guards are riding and then like AF's on stage. Roger's got the sickest long braided, like, long hair, and he's doing this wild dance that I don't think I've ever seen him do again. Like this kind of step arm dance. Have you seen this video? I don't think you're in the band at this point.
No.
Oh my gosh. It's so sick. It must be just before, I don't know actually when it kind of falls in the chronological period of the band, but it's like, it feels like they are a band that really got redeemed by coming back together in the '90s, and kind of the legacy was kind of cleaned up in a way, and people were like, looked at them and differently now, and kind of give them their, like, I mean, they were always given this sort of like their flowers in New York and in certain circles, but I mean, like, I think they're now accepted as the legends worldwide.
Yeah, I I think that is too. And I also think it has to do with like, just there's just such a better vibe around them than there is around like some other bands from that period or some other bands that have gotten back together from like later and earlier stages of hardcore. They, like you said, there's that familial vibe. And it, I think that extends to the fans as well. That they always seem like they're having fun, which is not how it was necessarily was when I was in the band and we were touring to like pay bills and stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, they just seem to do it now for fun more than anything else. And it, and that comes through. They're not bitter about anything either too. Like there's so many people from those scenes that those days that feel like they didn't get their due or whatever, like that they didn't get what should have been coming to them or whatever. Like, you know, they just resent the fact that they only sold like 30,000 records or something. Whereas like, to me, I was like, I can't believe like that I ever wrote a song that, you know, a couple hundred people would sing along at once. And I got that out of my system when I was young, which is good, because like when it became apparent that I wasn't going to be playing music for the rest of my life and I wasn't going to be doing it for a living, and that I was much better at doing the business thing than I was at playing, that I'd never, when people ask me if I miss it, I can honestly say like, no, I don't. Like I always enjoy the feeling of getting on stage and playing with old friends and like doing that. But like the idea of like going to like regular rehearsals and, you know, having downtime in a city where there's nothing to do, like overnight drives in a van, like that, I don't miss any of that stuff. It was always about like getting to that like 45 to 60 minutes that you would actually have fun, and the other 23 hours of the day were like the hard work, the slogging it out, which, well, I don't have to tell you. I mean, you've toured, you know what it's like.
It's maddening, you know, and that's why I think there's so many of these bands that are like, obviously people are drawn to this lifestyle that have certain mental issues, I'm sure. But I think the band thing really does feed it, you know, like you're living for 1 hour a day and the whole day is either nerves and excitement building up to it or trying to come down from it so you can go to sleep so you can do it all again the next day. And like you're saying, you're in a van, you know, like it's going to make you crazy. I got a lot of empathy for my crazy hardcore brethren.
Yeah, it's a hard life, and there's definitely a ceiling on I would say like a glass ceiling, but it's more of like a lead ceiling. Like there's a hard ceiling on how far you can make it in playing like traditional old hardcore. But what do I know? Like these, like Turnstile is playing like, you know, just before Metallica on some of these festivals. Like they're but they're really like an exception to the rule. Like they're definitely an outlier.
They are, but you almost need the outliers to keep the scene going. Like Blink-182 and the Offspring being on Nemesis Records and Green Day, yeah, of course, being on Lookout. Prior to that, you know, you have the Nirvana blowing up and carrying Sub Pop along with it. And you need these sort of flourishes, these bands to get popular, sort of populate the next scene, and to have a bunch of kids. Like, not everyone's going to stay and get involved in DIY stuff, but there'll be enough new kids that kind of find out about it and, like, you know, want to sneak out of the house and take the train to the city and see what's going on at these clubs.
Yeah, or even like Suicidal Tendencies, when all of a sudden they had a video on MTV in like 1983 or 84 or whenever.
Absolutely,
that was.
Yeah.
That definitely like ratcheted up the profile of the entire genre of music.
Or Saturday Night Live. Like, sorry, I mean, cut you off.
Yeah, go on. Yeah, Fear on SNL or the Minutemen getting the This Ain't No Picnic video on like MTV late night rotation, or Husker Du, Don't Want to Know If You're Lonely video.
No, I find there's a
actual like slam dancing in it. Like,
yeah, well, that Sick of It All videos with what is it, Step Down?
Yeah,
with the moshing, you know, seeing that on MTV or Much Music in Canada, obviously. And you know, how many kids got into it from seeing Rancid play that SNL slot, or Rancid on South Park, or
yeah,
you know, these sorts of like the one I find always amazing is Julian Casablanca wearing that Yeah Yeah Yeahs pin on SNL, and then everyone becoming obsessed with who the Yeah Yeah Yeahs were the next day in the music press that time. And it just felt like these sort of like large cultural beacon points that we used to have where everyone kind of would gather around and look to when something would break through and get on there from the underground. It would have incredible ripple effects that are still felt like I'm do a whole podcast about people that feel these ripples.
Yeah. I mean, the Devo on SNL was a dividing line culturally. Like the next Monday in high school, after that episode aired, it was like either you were like, I just saw the greatest band ever, or it had become an insult for the people who didn't think they were the greatest band ever. Honestly, that was like where the like, hey Devo, that was where that all started.
I gotta feel like obviously not quite as cool, but ultimately maybe arguably as cool a band. But for me, that was the Cramps on 90210.
Oh well, yeah, I mean, the Cramps were. They were so great. Fortunate that I saw them a bunch in the '80s. Even when I saw them in the '90s, like later on when they were playing like Hootenanny in Orange County, I was at that show for some reason. It was like the Cramps and Social Distortion and X all playing back to back, and they were always great. It was so, like anything that Lux and Ivy did was just so great.
Absolutely, like a true career, like an auteur career of the two of them, because yeah, like Flame Job, like those later records are still great. Like they may not be Goo Goo Muck, but they're still awesome records. They never let you down.
Yeah. And then Goo Goo Muck is in Wednesday show on Netflix that gets a whole new lease on life, and people are discovering the rest of the Cramps discography, hopefully.
Yeah, we're going to have a generation of bands that are informed by the Cramps just because of this Wednesday show popping up, and then all these kids led to it.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
It's amazing how that works. But anyway, I've kept you forever, and I know you've got a lot to do today, and I would love you to come back on at some point in the future if you're all ever right. free to talk about any of this stuff. But before I let you go, did Straw Dogs and AF overlap? Because you do that, there's a Straw Dogs record that comes out in 91. Or is that a compilation?
I was not on the record that was in 91. I recorded We Are Not Amused, which came out after I had left the band, but I played on it, recorded in 86, and I joined AF in late 86. The first shows I played with AF were like December of 86. And I played like the last few dates on the Cause for Alarm tour before we started writing Liberty and Justice. So it did kind of overlap a little in that the We Are Not Amused by the Straw Dogs came out like around the time that I was first playing shows in AF. I think We Are Not Amused came out in November of 86, and it was recorded that summer, if I recall correctly.
Okay, that makes sense. Steve, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you, Steve, for coming on the show. And hopefully Steve will be back at some point in the near future because we got a lot more to talk about. That was a lot of fun. Check out Agnostic Front, Liberty and Justice, and the Live in CBGB's record. And check out Straw Dog stuff. I think those Straw Dog records are super underrated. I love those records. And I'm definitely a massive FU's fan, too. So check out all the stuff Steve does. And look out for that name. You'll see it everywhere. All right. What'd you think, Cam? Did you like that episode? Thumbs up. I got a thumbs up right there. And you're thinking Turned Out of Punk. Okay, coming up on the next episode of Turned Out of Punk. Like that?
Yeah.
Okay, good. We got a great one coming up for the next episode. My new buddy, Nick Harmer from Death Cab for Cutie. This is a great episode. We talk about punk, hardcore, rebelling against your folks, then raising kids, and all sorts of stuff. This is a fun one. I'm excited for you to hear it. And that is coming up on the next one of Turned Out of Punk. All right, everyone. Thank you very much.
Punk.
I said Turned Out of Punk. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights.
and stop hate and violence towards people of different races and different faiths and different ethnicities, because
identities
and different identities too. Absolutely. Because this isn't politics we're talking about. This is just basic human rights stuff. People deserve to live free from hate, violence, and discrimination. So if there's organizations in your community that are affecting positive change, get involved. Donate your time, donate your money, or if you have it, and be the change you want to see. Speaking about being the thing you want to see, get involved with punk. Anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine, start
podcast.
There's too many of these podcasts out there. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, start a podcast. Start whatever. Just contribute to it, because it gets better when you get involved. Speaking about things getting better, sign your organ donor cards, because we've got family, right, Cam?
Yeah.
That had a transplant, an organ transplant, and it changed their life, saved their life.
Who?
Uncle Bill.
He did?
Yeah, the heart transplant. Don't you remember how sick he was before?
No.
You don't remember the way? You were very young when he was very sick, but he's now doing great because he had this heart transplant. So sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. They're just dead weight. They're just getting rid of the organs that have to get rid out of the body anyway. It's a little morbid. I'm sorry. I don't mean to bring down our conversation, buddy. And try meditating, because it does help. It can help calm you down. Do you meditate? You meditate at school sometimes, right?
Why did you mention meditating?
I always mention it on the podcast. It's not just because we saw a Bob's Burgers episode. Oh, someone sent me an email. It's not just because we saw a Bob's Burgers episode about it the other day. Or today.
Okay.
Well, do you have anything to say? Do you want to say anything to people?
No.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Stay safe, and I'll see you on the next episode. Bye.